This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. Hope your holiday season preparations are going well so far. Great to have you with me. And it is so great to have Charles Oldham back. He was first on the show in May of 2022 to tell us about his book, Ship of Blood, Mutiny and Slaughter Aboard the Harry A. Berwind and the Quest for Justice. At the end of the interview, he talked briefly about another book he had written back in 2018 called The Senator's Son, The Shocking Disappearance, The Celebrated Trial, and The Mystery That Remains a Century Later. And that book is the subject of our interview today. Thank you so much for returning to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes. So when did you first come across this story, and why did it interest you so much?
Well, I came across it just by chance, and this is, you may be surprised, but this is going back quite a ways. I came across a story back when I was in middle school, actually. I was about 13 years old, and you know, when I was that age, I was a fairly precocious, you know, history nerd, and I liked stories about old true crimes and that type of thing. And I happened to come across this book that was written back in the 1950s, and it was a collection of stories, of old true crime stories from North Carolina history in years past. And each of these stories contained in the book was just a basic summary. It was about 20 pages or so. But one of those stories was about a case that happened back in the year 1905 in Currituck County in eastern North Carolina. And it was a story about a young boy who disappeared very mysteriously. And it went into the fact that the boy's father was a local politician, and there were rumors that the child had been kidnapped by a man who had a political grudge against the boy's father. And it, like I said, it was just a sort of a thumbnail sketch of the story, just gave the basic facts. And after I read that when I was a kid, I came away thinking, well, you know, there must be something more to the story. The way the story was described in that book was that the defendant in the case, who supposedly had a political grudge against the boy's father, was angry at the boy's father, who was a state senator, because the senator had been a supporter of prohibition legislation, and this defendant was well known in the community as a bootlegger. And so for that reason, he supposedly kidnapped the senator's child and either murdered him or caused him to disappear in some other way. But I came away from that thinking, well, that just doesn't make sense. I mean, it's hard to believe that someone would do that to a young child, commit a crime like that with no more of a motive than just a political grudge over liquor legislation. And, you know, I thought about that for a while, and the story stayed with me for a long time. And as far as I knew, no one else had researched the case any more deeply than that, and no one had written a definitive account of the story. And so I thought, well, you know, at some point it would be really great if someone did that, did the research, and, you know, gave the story the kind of historical treatment that it deserves. So a number of years later, after I had been practicing law for a while, I decided, well, the heck with it. I'm going to give it a shot. I'm going to look into this story. I'm going to go through all the newspaper accounts and the historical record, and I'm going to see if I can figure out what happened here. And so that's how I came to tell the story. And what I discovered was there actually was quite a bit more to the story. And when you get down into the brass tacks of what North Carolina politics was like back in the early 1900s, you know, it's not all that inconceivable that a crime like that could have been committed. And of course, we can get into the details on that.
Yeah, for sure. So let's start, if you don't mind, with the town of Poplar Branch, North Carolina. 1905 is the year when much of this story takes place. What kind of community was it?
Well, at the time, it was a farming community. It was right on the shore of what they called Currituck Sound. It's right in the coastal, you might call it the inner coast of North Carolina, not too far from the Outer Banks. And back in 1905, it was just a very small community with some farms. And also, this is something that's unique about that area. It was an area that was very well known for duck hunting. That was one of the main sources of livelihood back in those days. People would come from all over to hunt the ducks and the geese that flocked along the Currituck Sound. So it was a very rural area at the time, and the folks who were involved in this particular crime were local farmers, basically. But I mean, that was typical of North Carolina back in the early 1900s.
So the Beasley family, Sam Beasley, his wife Kathy, they were a pretty prominent family in the area, right?
Oh, they were, yes. Yeah, Sam Beasley was the local politician that I mentioned just a moment ago. And in 1905, when the incident occurred, he was the state senator who represented Currituck County in the North Carolina legislature at the time. And he had actually been a state legislator for several years up to that point. He was first elected in 1898. He and his wife, Cassie, and they had three children. And they lived in a very, very attractive white farmhouse in this community, Poplar Branch, at the time. And their youngest child, youngest of the three kids, was a son. His name was Kenneth, and he was 8 years old. And he is the senator's son of the title of the book.
So how much is known about Kenneth? Was he a good kid?
Well, there's not that much personal recollection of what his personality was like at the time. But you can sort of imagine, when you think about, you know, children back in the early 1900s who grew up on isolated farms out in the countryside, what would you imagine the children spent most of their time doing? Most of the time, if he wasn't, you know, doing chores on the farm at home, as most children did at the time, he also had a school to attend. He attended a little two-room rural schoolhouse, which was about half a mile down the road from his house, which actually comes to play in the story. But you know, I would imagine that you know, any time that he wasn't either helping out on the farm at home, or if he wasn't in school, you could just imagine that he and the other kids in the neighborhood were probably out roaming around, playing games, just doing the things that children did back in those days before TV and before Minecraft and before internet and that type of thing. He was only 8 years old, so we're talking about roughly a third grader by today's category.
Right, yeah. So the morning of February 13th, 1905, it was a pretty ordinary one for the Beasley family. Kenneth, as usual, he woke up, he got ready for school.
That's true, yeah. And his daily routine back then, and this would have been true for his older sister as well. The kids, they walked to school. The schoolhouse, as I mentioned, was about a half a mile down the dirt road from the house where they lived, and that was nothing out of the ordinary. What was unusual was what happened later in the day when the kids went out for recess as part of their usual daily routine, but things went really badly after that.
Right. So his teacher was Miss Nina Harrison, and it was just like a regular morning, right? His cousin Benny remembered Kenneth getting his shoes wet when he had walked through some slush. So his shoes were drying off in a corner. They went through their regular morning school routine, and then they all went out to recess, where Kenneth spent time with his friends. But he was the only one of his classmates not to return, right?
Yes, exactly. The kids all went out for recess around noon, and what they did was they just went back into the backyard behind this little schoolhouse that they attended, which backed up against a stretch of swampland, some very densely forested swampy woods. And as it turned out, Kenneth was the only one of the children who did not return to the schoolhouse when the bell rang at the end of the recess hour. And what his teacher heard from the other kids was that he had wandered back into the woods, and for some reason he didn't return.
And it was Benny, right, who reported that Kenneth had told him at the end of recess that he had just wanted to go a little farther into the woods and would be back in a bit. And at first, when Kenneth doesn't return, there's not a giant concern. When the principal, as an example, is informed of Kenneth's absence, he tells one of the students just to go out and look for him.
Yeah, that's true. The teacher and the principal dispatched a couple of the other kids down to see if they could find Kenneth and bring him back. But they couldn't find him. And it was also around this time, bearing in mind that this was a pretty cold day in February. And it was also around this time that it started to rain outside, and as the temperature dropped, it started to turn into snow. And they began to think that maybe Kenneth had gotten lost back in the woods. And if that was the case, then they really needed to find him, because otherwise he would get cold, and he might, if he really was lost, he might die from hypothermia if they didn't find him. So it was at that point that people realized that it was a more serious matter.
So how is law enforcement first alerted? How do the Beasleys learn the news? And when does the search begin?
Well, Senator Beasley actually was not on the scene at the time. He was up in Raleigh because the state legislature was in session at the time. And what they did, the principal and the teacher, they sent out the word to the folks in the surrounding area. Now, bear in mind, again, this is a relatively sparsely populated area. But the people who lived there were duck hunters and fishermen. And so they were well accustomed to maneuvering through the woods and the swamps and that type of thing. So they formed a search party with however many people they could put together, and they started combing through the woods. And they realized that there was some urgency to the situation, because they thought they had a missing child and he might really be in danger. But they searched all through the rest of the day and even into the night, you know, carrying torches and whatever they'd find. But they couldn't find the child. And they kept up the search for the next couple of days, but they couldn't find any trace of him in the woods.
So this obviously causes a large level of concern. Everyone is out looking for him. And a letter comes in, and the writer of the letter mentions that Kenneth had, in fact, been spotted, or a boy that looked like Kenneth had been spotted heading out of town in the company of a strange man. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. And this is where the story gets a little bit hazy. And it's a little bit complicated to describe, but it was just a few days. I think it was about 5 or 6 days after Kenneth went missing. There was a story printed in the Raleigh News and Observer, which at the time was one of the major, probably the major newspaper that most people read in Eastern North Carolina at the time. And someone apparently had written in to the editors of the News and Observer, claiming that Kenneth had been kidnapped. And the person, whoever wrote this letter, they were never identified. They never came forward and said who they were. And in fact, there's even some question about whether there actually was a letter to the editor. It might also be that people were just speculating about what had happened to the boy. But anyway, if you read this story in the paper, you would have seen that someone apparently had written into to the editors and said that they had seen someone in the vicinity of Poplar Branch driving down a dirt road in a horse-drawn buggy, and they noticed that this man had a young child in the buggy with him, and apparently the child had seemed to be in distress of some sort. He was crying, and the man who was driving the buggy was trying to shush him in some way. And apparently this buggy, the driver, and the child were headed north towards Norfolk, Virginia, because if you look on the map, that's the direction that they would have been headed in. And this letter, again, if there was a letter, whoever wrote this letter pointed the finger specifically at a man named Joshua Harrison, who was a well-known farmer and landowner in Currituck County. The letter strongly hinted that Joshua Harrison was the man who was driving the buggy and was suspected to have been absconding with this child in his wagon. And this is where it gets, where really the political angle comes into it. Joshua Harrison was a well-known figure in the area. His brother-in-law was a former governor of North Carolina and also a former ambassador and United States senator. So Mr. Harrison had political connections of his own. And Joshua Harrison was also the father of Nina Harrison, who was Kenneth's teacher at the school. So you can hear the plot thickening here a bit.
Yeah, for sure. So this character, Harrison, as you've already said, he had some sort of a feud going on with Sam Beasley. But to add to all of the drama, Harrison had a shady past. He had been in trouble as a younger man.
Yeah, that's true. He was in his mid to late 60s in 1905, and he had married well because he had married the sister, he had married into a prominent family, and his wife was the sister of a fellow named Thomas Jarvis, and he was the former governor and senator that I mentioned. But despite that, you're absolutely correct. I mean, Mr. Harrison had a checkered past, because on at least two different occasions, this was back in the 1860s and 1870s when he was a considerably younger man, but he had been put on trial for murder twice in Currituck County. Once he had been put on trial for murdering another young boy who was around the same age that Kenneth Beasley was in 1905, and another time he had been put on trial for murdering his own father. He was found not guilty on both of those counts. But, I mean, if you just contemplate that for a moment, I mean, how many people can you imagine have been put on trial for murder twice and been found not guilty?
Right. And that possibility that he murdered a child.
Harrison claimed in court, apparently, that he had shot the child accidentally. And that's all we know. And that's... I found out as much as I could. I knew just from the court records, I knew the name of the child, and I could see that who his parents were, and I could see that they lived in Currituck County at the time, although they apparently moved away afterward. But I hate to say it, but that is really still a blank spot in the historical record. You know, I would love to have known more about that, but you know, what we know is just that he had allegedly shot and killed a young boy who was about 8 years old at the time.
Yeah, and his father's death. What happened between them, do you think, that led to that?
That also is another mystery. And, you know, what the court records reveal is that, you know, Mr. Harrison had several siblings. And at the time that his father passed away, There was also some civil litigation pending between the siblings, which I suspect was related to the disposition of the father's estate. So I'm not sure exactly what to make of that, but it's possible that murder charge might have been something that was trumped up, maybe by the other family members who were trying to exclude Joshua Harrison from his share of the inheritance, perhaps. I mean, that's one possibility. Apart from that, I don't really know what happened, except that he was eventually put on trial and he was found not guilty. So apparently the case against him didn't appear to be very strong.
Even if he was innocent of murder decades earlier, he still had a reputation in 1905 of being tempestuous, quick to anger, right?
That's very true, and it's you can see that just from court records. Again, they don't reveal very much, but when you go through the court docket books, say in the 1880s and the 1890s, you see Joshua Harrison's name quite a few times. He was charged with several other things, like disposing of property illegally, but also for a couple of assault and battery. His name is found charged with things like that. In most of those cases, though, he was found not guilty. But, you know, when someone has a rap sheet like that, a history of having that many accusations brought against him, you figure that you're dealing with a pretty, pretty irascible character.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah. Yep. So tell us about Nina Harrison's letter and what about it you found suspicious.
Well, when the local newspapers were reporting on the story, you know, in the first few days after Kenneth disappeared, everybody was speculating about what had happened. And after Kenneth had been missing for 5 or 6 days, even after all the local hunters and the fishermen had been sifting through the woods and they had searched out the swamp and so forth, when they didn't find any trace of him, you know, they figured that, you know, if he had gotten lost in the woods, and if he had died from the cold, then they would have found his remains somewhere. This is a little bit macabre, but some of the hunters mentioned that they kept watching the sky for buzzards, knowing that if the child had died in the woods, that buzzards would have been attracted to the remains. So they looked out for that, but they saw no sign of that. So when they found no trace of him, most people in the community concluded that there probably was foul play, that someone had snatched the child. And as I mentioned earlier in the News and Observer story, there were already rumors floating around that Joshua Harrison was involved in some way. And shortly after that, the boy's teacher, Miss Nina, who again was Joshua Harrison's daughter, she was quoted in one of the papers saying that, this is just such a tragedy. And, you know, it's a shame that Kenneth is no more, and he's not going to be returning home. And she talked about how aggrieved the Beasley family were going to be, and she expressed her own regret and her own grief over having lost a student whom she apparently really liked and cared about. One thing that people did find suspicious about that was that when the teacher was saying all this, it sounded like she was already convinced that the child was deceased and would never be returning home, when other people in the community were thinking that, you know, if he's been kidnapped, then the kidnapper's probably holding him for ransom and probably wants to return the child in exchange for some money or something like that. So some people thought it suspicious that the child's teacher would assume just offhand that he was dead in that way, and assume that he would not be returning home unless she had some kind of inside information and was trying to convince people that he had just gotten lost in the woods, when in fact most people thought that that was not the case.
We will be back after these brief messages.
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
One particular argument, he ended up dislocating Ava's jaw. Ava, she was such a tough cookie. Rather than cry or scream or anything like that, she...
Or call the police,
like she should have, exactly. Exactly. What does she do? She takes an ashtray and she knocks him over the head and knocks him unconscious. That's how she fought back. She didn't know what to do, so she called Louis B. Mayer. I think I've killed Howard Hughes. What do I do?
Revisit a time when the pictures were still big and everyone was ready for their close-up. When you want Tyrone Power instead of Tom Hardy, Jennifer Jones instead of Jennifer Lawrence, or Robert Mitchum rather than Robert Pattinson, then From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906 when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilley, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day, 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we have returned. So in your book, you compare this case to the Charlie Ross case in 1874.
Yes.
Would you summarize that case, that story for us, and what the similarities are to Kenneth Beasley's case in your mind?
Yeah. Charlie Ross, that was a case that happened in Philadelphia, and it's best known as the first ransom kidnapping that ever happened in the United States. Young boy, he was about 4 years old, was kidnapped from his family's front lawn in suburban Philadelphia. And shortly after that, the people who snatched the child communicated with his parents and made a ransom demand. And this was a sensational story all over the country because no such crime had ever occurred in the United States up to that point. And it struck everyone as being just atrociously cruel and sadistic and just unprecedented, which it was. The aftermath of the kidnapping is a little bit complex, but the boy's father, Charlie's father, tried to communicate with the kidnappers, and this was all done behind the scenes, but he made some attempts to try to make contact with them and actually pay the ransom. But he had to do that secretly because he was under a good bit of pressure in the public, because the press was reporting on his every move, and a lot of journalists and politicians and people like that were saying that he really should not pay the ransom. He shouldn't reward this type of criminal behavior, even in an attempt to try to get his child back, because that would be an irresponsible thing to do, and it would encourage other kidnappings and that type of thing. So the boy's father was walking a very, very fine line in trying to be an upstanding citizen and also try to get his child back. So that drama went on for several months. I forget exactly how much longer it took, but it was almost a year later. The kidnappers were actually found. They were in the process of burglarizing a house in New York, some distance from Philadelphia, and they were both shot and killed while they were in the process of stealing from this house. But one of the guys, even though he had been shot, he lived just long enough to utter a confession. He said, "Yeah, my partner and I here, we were the ones who stole the Ross child, and I don't know where he is right now. My partner over here, he knew where he is, but the child will be released within the next few days." And then he died. The child was never found, though, so it was just a very sad situation all around. But anyway, it was remembered as, you know, it was the first such case that ever occurred. And when Kenneth Beasley disappeared later on, this was about 30-some years later, people started thinking about that also, even though it wasn't clear at first that a ransom demand had been made in the Beasley case. But everybody noticed the similarities.
Very interesting, yeah. So Joshua Harrison was arrested, indicted, and he took as his attorney his brother-in-law, the former governor.
That's true. It's interesting, though, that Harrison was not actually accused, and he was not indicted until a full year and a half after Kent disappeared. Kent disappeared in February of 1905, and it was not until, I think it was September of 1906, that the charges were brought. And later on in the book, I speculate about what might have led to the delay in that. But I mean, frankly, I think that's the biggest mystery of all, as to what in the world was going on in the 18 months between the kidnapping and the charges. But yes, Mr. Harrison, once he was charged with the kidnapping, he did retain his brother-in-law, the former governor and senator, Thomas Jarvis. And he also retained a fellow named Charles Aycock, who was also a former governor of North Carolina. So those were his two lead attorneys, and he retained also a couple of other attorneys. So he had four defense attorneys at the time, which was very unusual for any type of criminal case in North Carolina back in those days. So he was well defended.
And very interestingly, Sam Beasley, father of Kenneth, basically takes charge of the prosecution, right?
Yeah. And, you know, the rules have changed since then. But back then, it was typical if a crime victim's family had the money to do it, then they could retain special prosecutors to prosecute the case for them. And that's what Senator Beasley did. He brought in a couple of the prominent attorneys in the area, and they became the prosecutors on his behalf. So the trial, which actually took place in early 1907, the trial was actually in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, which is about 20 miles away from Currituck County. They had to move the trial because of the publicity and perceived hostility toward the defendant in Currituck County. But anyway, it made for a very, very interesting courtroom drama, because most of the high-profile legal talent in that part of North Carolina was involved in this case, because it was such an important conspicuous case.
In those 18 months, was Joshua Harrison just kind of living his life, going along as normal?
And that's the real mystery. That was what I most wanted to find out, was what was going on during that time period. Because right after Kenneth disappeared, when Senator Beasley was quoted in the papers, he said, "Well, you know, I firmly believe that my son has been kidnapped, and I believe he's being held for ransom, and I want to do whatever I can to get my child back." So essentially trying to signal his willingness to negotiate with the kidnapper. But at the same time, you know, he had to be cautious about that, because bearing in mind he was a public official and there were certain demands upon him in terms of civic responsibility, and he had to be cautious that he wasn't giving in to criminality. And it was the same pressure that Charlie Ross's father had faced in the same situation. So that was the biggest question in my mind, was there something going on behind the scenes, out of the eyes of the reporters, journalists, and that type of thing? Was there some kind of back channel negotiation going on between Senator Beasley and the kidnapper? And if Senator Beasley suspected, as other people seemed to, that Joshua Harrison was the kidnapper, was he trying to reach out to him and cut a deal? Maybe do some kind of backroom exchange of money or something like that. So that was the biggest question I had. And, you know, I did find some clues here and there, but nothing definitive one way or the other. What I came away from, or what I came away with, was basically a suspicion that there probably was an attempt to pay the ransom and to get his child back, but the transaction fell through in one way or another. And that's what eventually resulted in the criminal charges being filed.
Huh. So there were some really interesting moments that happened in this trial, and one of them was when this information about a pocket knife was presented, a pocket knife supposedly given to Kenneth. What was the significance of that?
Yeah, that was something that you know, Senator Beasley testified to at the trial. He mentioned that actually the very last night before Kenneth went missing. When the family was all at home in Poplar Branch, Kenneth came up to his father and showed him this little pocket knife that he had. And his father had never seen this pocket knife before, and he said that he was just mildly curious about where Kenneth had gotten it, but he didn't really give it much thought at the time because there was no reason to. He figured that Kenneth had probably gotten it from one of his friends, maybe traded it to him for some marbles or something like that, the type of thing that children would have done back then. But the significance of it was that, or the hint was that perhaps someone had given the pocket knife to Kenneth as some sort of inducement, as a gift, maybe to persuade him to walk back into the woods at recess for some nefarious reason. So that was that's one of the small clues that were hinted at the trial.
Yeah. So an important part of the trial would be the testimony by the witnesses who claimed to have seen the man and the boy in the buggy. Prosecution witnesses said it was definitively Joshua Harrison. Defense witnesses said it was not.
Yes. Yeah. And at that point, you start to speculate about, you know, one of those people who testified for the prosecution, who said that they did see Joshua Harrison driving the cart with the mule, with the child in the buggy and so forth. You figure one of those people was probably the one who wrote that letter to the newspaper some months ago, or at least that's what you would imagine. As you would also imagine, you know, when those people gave that testimony, the defense attorneys came in and said and asked them, well, if you saw this going on, you know, if you saw a man driving away from the scene with a child in the buggy, and shortly afterward you heard the story about the child who had gone missing in the woods, then why did you not alert the authorities? Why didn't you call the sheriff at the time? Which was a perfectly fair question to ask. And the only answer that those witnesses could give was, well, I just didn't think it was my business. So that kind of left the doubt hanging in the air. You know, why didn't they act sooner? Did they actually go to the sheriff and make a report about it? Or was it also possible that maybe these people, after seeing this, they just went back to Sam Beasley and said, Joshua Harrison is the one who kidnapped your child, and you need to do something about that and reach out to him and either send the sheriff after him or pay him the money that he wants. So that's what a lot of the testimony in the courtroom tended to focus on, was who saw what and how credible were they, and if they really did see what they claimed to have seen, then why didn't they act on it sooner?
One of the more sensational bits of testimony came from a man named Thomas Clingman Woodhouse. He said that he had run into Joshua Harrison not long after Kenneth had disappeared. And he said that Harrison had said some pretty callous things about Kenneth's disappearance. And I wrote this down. He said, Beasley's making a damned sight of fuss about one little boy. Give us two women, and we can make us two nicer boys in a few minutes. That's a pretty cold-hearted statement, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. That fellow Woodhouse is a, I think he's a pretty interesting figure in this whole thing. And what it seems to me was that he was probably an intermediary between Beasley and Harrison. And you know, Woodhouse claimed that after he had that conversation with Harrison that you just described, Woodhouse also claimed that Harrison had told him that he did in fact have the child in his custody. He was keeping him hidden somewhere. And Harrison supposedly was complaining that Beasley had never offered enough money, and if he would just do so, then he would let the child go. And Woodhouse also testified that he also claimed that he went to Sam Beasley, told him this, and Beasley then urged him to go back to Harrison and say, oh, I'll pay you whatever money you want. I just want my child back. And then, according to Woodhouse, apparently Harrison he clammed up and didn't want to talk about it any further. Woodhouse testified to all of this in court, of course. And supposedly it was just after that when Beasley decided to go public and pursue the criminal charges against Harrison. I have some doubts about exactly how it went down. I think the story that that Woodhouse told was frankly a little bit melodramatic, and it sounded a little bit made up. But there is some reason to suspect that that Woodhouse may very well have been the conduit, the guy who was set up to do the communication and to try to work out the deal. But it fell through for whatever reason.
So did Harrison have an alibi?
Well, the alibi that he stated in court was that he was that on the day of the disappearance, he was simply at home on his farm, working in his fields along with his family members. And as you might imagine, he had his wife and his children and in-laws who all took the stand and testified to that effect. So it came down to a question of credibility. The jurors had to compare, you know, who was testifying for the prosecution and how credible were they? Did they have any reason to lie, to make up a false story about Harrison, as opposed to, you know, Harrison's alibi witnesses, who most of whom were his immediate family members who, and might very well have had a motivation to cover for him. So in the end, it seemed apparent to the jury that the prosecution witnesses seemed to have less of a credibility problem than the defense witnesses.
I don't know anything about farming in North Carolina, but was there a lot to be done in the fields in February?
That's a very fair question, because you know, if you recall, on that particular day when the boy went missing, it was raining and snowing outside. And as you might imagine, that was a question that the prosecutors asked on cross-exam. They said, well, what do you mean you were out in the fields working when it was snowing and raining?
Yeah. So you spent much of your career as a criminal defense attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just curious, did you approach this case from that perspective? Or did you try to step away from that and look at things from a broader perspective?
Yeah. Well, you're right. I mean, for most of the time that I was a practicing attorney, and most of the time when I was doing criminal law, I was a criminal defense attorney. So I sort of put myself in the shoes of, you know, Thomas Jarvis and Charles Aycock and the guys who were called upon to represent this particular client. And you'd have to face the fact that they had a difficult task. They had this client who had as we've already noted, he had a very checkered history. He had political connections of his own, but he was well known in the community as being a pretty disreputable type, not just as a bootlegger, but also as just an all around bully and angry, aggressive person. And now he was accused of having kidnapped a child. The type of act that strikes a lot of people as being a very cruel and sadistic type of crime. So I was, thinking, well, how in the world are they gonna pitch this in court? How are they going to try to prevent this man from being crucified by raw emotion when the jurors are probably going to feel a lot of sympathy for the grieving parents of this child and so forth? So yeah, that was definitely weighing on my mind as I went through it. And I had to conclude in the end that the attorneys who represented Joshua Harrison, they just had a very difficult task. And the trial that their client received, I have to conclude that it was not a fair trial. I mean, if for one thing, just because the rules of court were different at the time, and the prosecutors got away with a lot of tactics that simply aren't allowed anymore. But you know, just the fact that of the just the nature of the alleged offense and the political sentiment of the day and, you know, the prejudice against the defendant, even if he did it, he had the deck stacked against him from the beginning. So it was hard for him to get a fair trial under those circumstances.
Would you have done something differently if you had been defending Joshua Harrison?
I'm trying to think back to, you know, the specific people who testified at the time. I also have to bear in mind just the logistical difficulties that any attorney had to deal with back then, because, I mean, good Lord, they didn't have internet. They didn't even have telephones, barely, at the time. I mean, the amount of preparation that you try to do in advance of a trial these days, when you're interviewing witnesses and you're putting together depositions and you're putting all your ducks in the row and making sure that you know exactly what you're going to present and what your witnesses are going to say, you know, it's difficult enough today, but, you know, back then, when they had no technology and when those attorneys were arriving in Elizabeth City for the trial for the first time, and in fact, they were probably meeting with the witnesses for the very first time just in the hours before the trial started, it's hard for me to say that I could have done anything better or that I could have done much of anything differently. What I have to conclude is that both the defense attorneys and the prosecutors, I mean, they had their deck of cards handed to them, such as they were. I mean, the prosecutors had they had witnesses who had some credibility issues of their own, and they were dealing with an indictment that was issued, you know, a year and a half after the alleged act. So there are some questions of credibility, questions of process that are going to occur in people's minds at the time. And of course the defense attorneys, they had their own problems with a very, very dislikable client and just a really emotionally charged crime that was being alleged. So it made for a very interesting courtroom drama. And I would have to say the attorneys did the best they could. And I would say that the verdict turned out in the way that people would have predicted in the beginning. Not to get ahead of ourselves, but Mr. Harrison, he was actually found guilty, which is not too surprising considering when you put together everything that we've talked about. It was just a very colorful process all along.
We will be back again momentarily.
Hi, I'm Matt Albers, host of the Pirate History Podcast. The men and women of the golden age of piracy are some of the most infamous and often misunderstood characters in all of human history. You know their names. Captain Morgan, Anne Bonny, Henry Avery, Mary Read, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard. But do you know their stories, their real stories? Every week over on the Pirate History Podcast, we explore the real lives of these pirates. We examine what made these pirates sail the high seas in search of plunder and adventure and revenge. The real stories are a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the stories most of us have been told. If you'd like to hear the stories of the real men and women who went on the account and sailed under the black flag, join us on the Pirate History Podcast.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
And we have returned again. I wanted to ask you about Margaret Gallup, his other daughter. Would you tell us a little about her and what her possible involvement might have been in all of this?
Yes, Margaret Harrison Gallup was the older daughter of Joshua Harrison. As you recall, his other daughter was Nina Harrison, who was the teacher in Poplar Branch. But Harrison's older daughter was the keeper of a boarding house in Norfolk, Virginia, which is about 60 miles up the road from Currituck County. And it was widely rumored that Harrison, if he did in fact kidnap the child, He probably took the boy up to Norfolk, and he might have gone to the boarding house that his daughter maintained, and that might have been his hideout, the place where he might have kept the boy locked up in the attic or something like that when he was trying to collect the ransom from the boy's parents. And Margaret Gallup, she as you might imagine, she took the stand at the trial, and she testified on her father's behalf. Said, "Oh no, I never saw any sign of the child, and my father never brought the child to my house or anything like that." And the newspaper accounts at the time, the way they described her testimony, they did not get a favorable impression of her. They remarked that she was really flaunting herself, and she was really jovial and flippant with the prosecutor when he was questioning her, and apparently she just did not come across very well in the eyes of the reporters who were covering the trial. And supposedly, just as she was wrapping up her testimony, she asked a question of the prosecutor, and she said, "Well, is there anything else you want to know? You know, I've come a long way to tell my story here, and is there anything else that, you know, I can, any other question that I can answer for you?" And the prosecutor shot back at her and said, "Well, there's only one other thing you can tell me, ma'am. Where is the child?"
Yeah.
You know, indicating, of course, that he was not taken in by her story and her style of dress or anything like that.
A very dramatic moment, yes.
Yeah, you get the impression that it was dramatic, although I have to admit, and this is something that I found when I was doing all the research and I was reading all of these old newspaper articles. A lot of the language in newspaper articles back then was just really spare. And newspaper writers back then, they used a lot of oblique language that's frankly a little bit hard to decipher these days. Some of it is descriptive enough that you can get the idea of what they're talking about, but it's hard to really grasp the full picture of what was going on. And that was one example, you know, because I don't know exactly all the wording of the repartee that occurred between Ms. Gallup and the prosecutor. And I really wish that I could have had a printed transcript of the trial itself, which unfortunately didn't exist at the time. But anyway, just we're fortunate at least that we did have newspapers, and a lot of them are available. You can find them in the archives, and we have that as a resource at least.
Yeah, true. So Harrison, as you've already said, is in his mid-60s, and he gets a 20-year sentence. And evidently not wanting to spend his retirement years behind bars, he decides to take his fate into his own hands.
He did. You know, this is something that still holds true today when it comes to prison. I mean, people who go to prison for harming children are pariahs. They are not well liked by their fellow inmates in prison. And Harrison, I imagine he realized this, and he realized that being an older man in his mid-60s, if he was sent to prison, and imprisonment back then meant imprisonment at hard labor, was the understanding at the time. So he knew that prison was not going to work out well for him in many different ways. So as you'd imagine, he did have the resources to get his attorneys to appeal the case to the North Carolina Supreme Court. And while they were doing that, the court actually allowed him to post a bond so that he could remain out of jail while the appeal was being heard. So his attorneys, Charles Aycock and his brother-in-law, they appealed the case. They gave an impassioned argument before the state Supreme Court, and they said, well, this trial was flawed because of the immense public emotion and prejudice against my client, and the courtroom was really just a political rally, and he never had a chance, and so forth. The Supreme Court ruled against them, and they upheld the conviction and the sentence, and so Mr. Harrison knew that he was going to have to report to prison and spend the rest of his life there. So, as you mentioned, he took affairs into his own hands, because just a few days before, when I think he realized that the decision was coming and it wasn't going to do him his favor, so he absconded and he ran off to Norfolk, Virginia, and he was later found in a hotel there. The local police were able to trace his whereabouts somehow, and they found him, and the Norfolk police went to his hotel room to take him into custody. And just as they were about to do that, Mr. Harrison took his own life. He shot himself with a pistol shot to the head, suicide. And he left a suicide note saying, "I'm innocent. I have no idea what happened to that child. I had nothing to do with it. But I'm an old man and I can't do time in prison. So goodbye, cruel world."
Yeah. So there are a number of theories you go into about what might have happened to little Kenneth in the conclusion of your book. So just for a moment, let's assume that the man in the buggy was Harrison, and he had lured Kenneth into the woods, you know, out of spite, his hatred of Sam Beasley, and with the intent to demand a ransom, to inflict some emotional and financial pain on the Beasleys, but not to kill the boy. And it seems like a pivotal moment in his plans. Where things really went wrong was when the witnesses came forward and identified him. Suddenly he was connected to the case, his anonymity was gone, and then it becomes extraordinarily difficult to negotiate a ransom and a release when everyone already suspects you. So that witness identification could well have led to the murder of Kenneth Beasley.
Yeah, that's probably it. In fact, you know, I would tend to think that, you know, Harrison, you know, just in those first few days after Kenneth went missing, when the rumors started appearing in print, people talking about having seen Mr. Harrison, you know, driving away with the child, you know, even though the newspapers were reporting it sort of in the abstract, in the hypothetical, just as a rumor, I tend to think that Harrison must have realized at that point that he had been spotted in the act of carrying the child away. He may well have thought initially that if he could just, you know, grab the kid, run off with him, and avoid detection at first, you know, if he did that, then he could, you know, communicate with Beasley and say, "All right, well, I've got your kid, so you've messed around with me politically. You tried to shut down my liquor business and so forth. So screw you. I mean, I've got your kid, so you're going to have to pay up." That may very well have been his motive in the beginning. And he thought he could get away with it. He could maybe extort a quick ransom and do it quietly. I suspect that was probably Harrison's motive in the beginning. I found some evidence, in fact, that he was facing financial trouble, maybe as a result of the damage to his bootlegging income. So maybe he really did need some money, and he saw this as a way of doing it. And in the process, at the same time, he could, you know, just exact some revenge on the Beasley family, whom he despised. So I suspect you're correct. That probably was the motive in the beginning. But once he realized that he had been spotted, and he knew that the press were on to him, and he saw that the newspapers were going to be treating this as a sensational case, and they were going to keep following it, I think he realized that he was in a bind, and if he had the child on his hands, the child was evidence of the crime, and this is a really horrible thing to contemplate, but he probably figured that he was going to have to dispose of the evidence of the crime, which would mean eliminating the child. So again, that's a horrible thing to consider, and it's just a sort of a clinical way of expressing it. But I'm afraid that the case probably did turn into a murder, even if murder was not the original intent. Now, if Harrison did dispose of the child and then buried him out in the swamp someplace, it still doesn't account for what happened in those intervening 18 months. I mean, what was going on between then? I mean, was Harrison actually keeping the child hostage that whole time, still thinking that he was going to release him at some point? Or did he murder the child, and even after doing that, did he try to extort the ransom from Beasley? And which, I mean, that opens up a whole new dimension of cruelty and sadism, you might say, but That's still up in the air. I don't know exactly how that went down. So I speculate that there was some attempt to collect the ransom, but I don't know exactly how it went down and exactly when it occurred. That's the lingering mystery.
Yeah. Another part of this that bothered me, and I'm sure it bothered you too, was his daughter Nina's involvement in all of this. But as you suggest in your book, Joshua Harrison seemed to rule over his family, you know, with an iron fist. And Nina was likely just following orders, completely unaware that she was putting Kenneth into real danger.
Well, that was my impression. Because the Harrisons, as far as I could tell, they were a close family. Joshua Harrison, he had the two daughters, and he also had three adult sons who lived nearby and worked on the same farm with him. So they did appear to be a close-knit family group. So as you might imagine, I mean, he Joshua Harrison, being the patriarch of this family, he probably, when he told his children to do something, they probably followed along. So it's entirely possible to me that they might have been aware of this kidnapping plan that he had, if he did in fact have it. And it's conceivable to me that his daughter, being the teacher who knew the child and was, you know, interacting with him on a daily basis. Again, this is really nefarious to contemplate, but was Nina the one who gave Kenneth that pocket knife as some sort of inducement to try to get him to wander down into the woods for some reason? When looking at this, I just thought, if Harrison did it, if he did snatch the child, then how did he end up meeting up with the child back in the woods? Was that just by chance? Did Kenneth just happen to wander back in the woods because he wanted to skip school or something like that, and he just happened to meet up with Harrison back there as a random encounter? I thought that seemed pretty unlikely. It just seemed to me that there was probably some type of premeditation in the way that meetup would have occurred back in the woods. And it seemed logical to me that, you know, if Harrison did it, then maybe his daughter was the one who arranged it in some way.
Yeah, yeah. And poor little Kenneth, he had left his coat in the classroom when he had gone out for recess that day. So if he had simply gotten lost, or he had fallen, or something like that, it's cold in February, even in North Carolina, especially when you're not dressed for it. And there was a point in the trial when some of the searchers were questioned, and they claimed that the woods were not, in fact, completely searched. So there is a chance, a small one, I'm sure, but a chance that if one of these scenarios had happened, that the remains of Kenneth might still be out there somewhere.
Oh, it is possible. And it's interesting, if you were to go to that area today, it's kind of neat because a lot of that swampland is still there. You know, despite the development in the area, you can still get a sense for what that topography looked like at the time, because a lot of it still looks that way. And it's tidal swamp. And, you know, on this particular day, it does seem like that a good bit of the area behind the schoolhouse was flooded with water. So, and especially in winter, there was some speculation that Kenneth might have wandered back there. He might have slipped on some ice and fallen in and drowned. But in the book, I get into a little bit of the science of drowning and bodies and what happens to human remains when they're submerged in water and that type of thing. So my conclusion on that was that if he had fallen into the water, chances are that the remains would have been found. And the same goes with if he had just gotten lost in the woods and died from hypothermia, I think the remains would have been found. It's true that the searchers, when they were going through the area, they didn't have any systematic plan for setting out a grid or anything like that. Not like you would do it today with computer-generated maps and GPS and that type of thing. But I do tend to think that the area itself was it was a small enough area that the searchers probably would have, they would have found something. And as since they started the search within an hour or so after Kenneth went missing, I mean, they were moving through the woods and they were calling out Kenneth's name and making lots of noise. And I would tend to think that if the child had been, even if he had gotten momentarily lost out in the woods, they would have seen him, or they would have heard him, or he would have heard them calling his name. And when you take all of that into account, I think it's more likely than not that he did not get lost. I don't think he got lost in the woods, and I don't think he fell into the water, with all things considered. So there's plenty of doubt. You can't really conclude anything definitively here, but as I express in the book, I think the most likely explanation was foul play. Really, that's just excluding all of the less likely possibilities.
The chances are slim, I know, but if there's someone out there with a metal detector who wants to search the area for a pocket knife?
Well, that would be a very interesting discovery. After almost 120 years, I can't hold out much hope that you could ever find something like that. And I don't think it would be wonderful if, well, not wonderful, but it would bring some sort of resolution if we could find the burial site somewhere. That's an intriguing thought, but I'd have to say that after the passage of this much time, I think that's pretty unlikely.
Yeah, for sure. Well, this has been so great. Thank you so much for coming back to talk about this case. Both The Senator's Son and Ship of Blood are available online and in bookstores. What do you recommend for people who want to reach out to you, find out more about your work? Where do we direct them?
Well, by all means, if anyone is interested in obtaining the book, the best recommendation I make is to contact my publisher directly and to order directly from my publisher, which is known as Beach Glass Books. It's a publishing outfit. It's based in Richmond, Virginia, and the website is www.beachglassbooks.com.
Perfect. I will include a link in the show notes. Again, appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, it's my pleasure, and thank you so much for having me.
Once more, I have been speaking to Charles Oldham. He is the author of The Senator's Son, The Shocking Disappearance, The Celebrated Trial, and The Mystery That Remains a Century Later. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.